Welcome to Bending the Arc. Bending the Arc is an offering of the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition, and we are in conversation with people working for equal justice and criminal legal system reform. I am your host, Sharon Brizalera. I help coordinate the Shasta Equal Justice, and this is a partnership with KKRN, Community Supported Radio, out of Round Mountain and Bella Vista, California, supported by community members like you. Welcome to the studio, Sheriff Johnson. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us.
And oh, absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity.
Right. And I want to say before we begin, we're going to begin with you introducing yourself as how you see fit, but we at the Equal Justice Coalition have really appreciated your openness to all of our questions.
Thank you. That's my job, and that's what it's supposed to be about. So whether those questions are controversial or difficult to wade through, that's fine. I'm okay with that. That's what I expect, and my job is to serve the community, so thank you.
Yeah, great. So I thought we'd begin for the context. I was reading up a little bit about your history, and if you could just share with listeners sort of how you came to get on this path of law enforcement. And
yeah, sure. I started my journey into this career way back out of high school. I was working in construction and at a lumber mill, and I got my AA degree through night school at the community college, and with the intention that I was going to transfer to Humboldt State, go get my degree there, and end up being a fish and game warden. And so I did. I made that transition to Humboldt. I lived in Eureka, bought a house, got married, and was going through college. After I got my bachelor's degree, I went to the Napa Fish and Game Academy, which is a post academy, and graduated from that, came back, and was your typical poor college student. I mean, we were struggling and just trying to wait around. I tested with the state. I did very good and was on the list. And it's just taking forever. And I got tired of waiting, and we were poor. So I said, okay, well, I'll apply with the local PD and try to get on with the PD until the state comes around to finally offering me a job or getting there. So I did. And lo and behold, I liked it. And what do you know, I was actually pretty good at it. So when the state did come around and offer me a job with Fish and Game, I declined it, and I stayed in law enforcement. So that's where I started my career, the Eureka Police Department. I was a patrol officer. I worked graveyards by choice most of my career. I was on the SWAT team. I was on as an evidence technician. I was a mentor for troubled youth. I was assigned to a narcotics unit. I had a canine. I did vice. I did virtually everything there. Really enjoyed the job, enjoyed the work, and youth has always been kind of my focus with that. It's probably the reason I've stayed in law enforcement my whole career. I care because youth, you can actually change their course and their break the chain and the cycle with them. Adults, not so much. They make their own decisions and they're going to do what they do, but kids always got a shot. So that's kind of why I've stuck with it. And then Eureka Police Department sent me to the FBI Academy with the intentions of promoting me within. I did that, graduated, I came back, and actually got an opportunity to be the chief of police of Ione, which is Amador County. So I went there. I was chief of police for 5 years there. Wanted to get back to the North State somewhere. The opportunity came up with the Anderson Police Department. I applied there, became the Anderson chief. I was there for about 10 years. And actually ready to retire, Sharon. I was, I've been in long enough, and this opportunity came up with the Shasta County Sheriff's Office, and they were struggling. Some people in the community asked me if I would consider, trying to help the community with this agency and this organization. And I know it sounds very cliche-ic, but I actually care. And so rather than retire, I said, yeah, I'll give it a shot, see if I can help the community. And this is where I plan to end up staying. So I wanted to make it better. So I was appointed as a sheriff, and then I ran for the term, and I won that election, and I'm continuing to serve as such. And you know, as you and I were talking, coming up the stairs here, it's been a ongoing professional development for me. I've went on to get my master's degree in criminal justice, and I've taken about every course that the Peace Officer Standards and Training has to offer, and I just furthered my education and my knowledge, and being around some real mentors and experience in my profession, and tried to absorb that and not only look at how to do it right, but also look at how people are doing it wrong, and promising I'll never do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that makes who you are to a degree, and
absolutely, and
what the agency's philosophy is.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we first spoke to you is soon after you came in office, and by we, I mean at the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition. And at the time you were focusing on connecting with communities, attending to the culture of the force, and certainly other goals have emerged since then. So I'm wondering if you could walk us through how you navigated changing the culture of the force, or working within that culture, and what goals have emerged as really critical currently.
Yeah, sure. So when you come into any agency, this is my personal philosophy. I'm not saying it's gospel for everybody, but has been to try to understand the culture and the organization that you're coming into, especially me coming out of a municipal police department to a sheriff's department. They're vastly different. And I don't even aspire or claim to have the knowledge of a sheriff's office coming in there, right? There's a lot to learn. And it's a lot bigger organizations than I've been in, and there's a lot of different aspects to it. There's politics involved. There's, you know, contract cities. There's rural areas. There's Office of Emergency Services. All of that, and that culture is very much built around all of those things. So, as I came in, primarily what I was trying to do was understand what the agency's about, what the Office of the Sheriff does as far as service for the community, and what the philosophies are behind it. And what I found out in this agency, there was very much, is very much siloed. For instance, you have a Bernie substation, and they operated kind of independently, and the Shasta Lake City, contract city operated independently, and everybody was pretty fragmented, and they had some real systemic leadership issues, and not the command staff was not cohesive. So before I can make any sort of move forward for the organization as a whole, I had to solve the command staff problem, because without a good leadership team and without being able to trust each other and know each other, and me, not just me trust them, but them trust me, we were going nowhere. So that was the first thing I worked on. We came a long way with that hurdle, and then we started to filter out the philosophy down the ranks. And it's by no means are we there and have solved all the problems, or we haven't solved all the problems, but mm-hmm. we've come a long way. And the change in probably as far as the community would see or notices and tells me is the service and what the focus is. Because before, it used to be a very reactive department, meaning we'd sit around and wait for somebody to call in and say, hey, I need a deputy here. Then we'd go, and that's all we do, to a proactive a law enforcement agency where we actually seek out the problems in our community, the problem people in our community, and we try to be proactive and address those things.
Mm-hmm. Culture change is such a fascinating concept. And I remember you coming and being very clear, and it was such a relief to hear, too. Like, there's a lot to understand here before we walk in and start making changes. How are you leading the kind of changes that you want to see? How does that look?
Yeah, that's
on the ground.
It's actually, you're right, it's complex, but it's certainly a very fair question, and it's difficult to navigate. But I'll tell you, leading by example is a big deal with me. You know, never asking somebody to do something I'm not willing to do myself. And I don't just say that, I actually do it. So I try to go out to calls. I try to go on ride-alongs. I try to be a part of the Deputy Sheriff's Association. I try to be present, very much so. And it's certainly not all about me. My biggest focus probably at this point in time is starting to move and develop a mentorship program from the top down. So it's more than just trainings, right? We all have trainings that we do, go to trainings. That's really the job skill set. That's not the culture. The culture is very dependent on people in leadership positions or in rank positions to be able to mentor people through and show people the way. And we've lost a lot of that in law enforcement, and certainly our profession with a lot of type A personalities are not the best communicators all the time. So you ask what I do to cultivate that. I'm big on trying to get my command staff and my sergeants to further their education, further their community involvement. I send different officers and command staff to radio shows, to interviews, to public presentations. So it's not just Mike Johnson going out there, being on the stage, being the face of the agency. It's all them that's the face of the agency too. And so, and that's a process. That's a long process, and not certainly not something this agency was used to, because that's just not how it operated before. And I'm not putting it down anybody. Mm-hmm. It was just different. And that's kind of what we're doing moving forward here. And again, Sharon, when we're talking about an agency the size of the Shasta County Sheriff's Office, that's a big task, because I've got a lot of commanders and a lot of supervisors that, you know, influence a lot of different people. So me staying connected with all those and monitoring those and observing those and getting clear information back to me so we can keep the ship going the right direction is a big task. But it's fun. I love my job. I love the people I work with, and I love the community. So that part makes it easy.
Yeah. Well, that's helpful. Thank you. Thank you. You know, the coalition is out there looking at best practices, promising practices, and we had the crisis intervention response team maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago from Reading Police Department speak to us, and people were very impressed with what they had to say, the training that they received, and it looked like what they were accomplishing. And I know the Sheriff's Department there were plans to have a similar team. And so I just wanted to ask you where we were in that process, what are you thinking, what are some of the barriers?
Sure, that's you're right, we did talk about that before, and first of all, phenomenal program. Reading Police Department is doing an awesome job with that, as they are with the mental health partners they're doing, and we fully support that and want to be on board with that as well. The challenge and the shift in that priority was primarily led by staffing. And I was way optimistic in that we would come up to staffing maybe a little quicker than we did. And then I had the crisis at the jail with all the people that quit and having the floor shut down and everything that was going on with that. So we kind of strayed away from that as being a priority and trying to get the jail going and try to get our patrol staff going. So we have done that now, and things are starting to turn around on both ends of that, on both the jail and patrol. So as patrol comes up, it's still on our priority list. We still have it. Actually have a board going of things we want, and that one still remains there. Now, we shifted maybe the philosophy of how we're going to go about that, because we were originally talking about maybe partnering with Reading and mental health and doing that sort of thing. But I think what we want to do now, because Reading's having so much success and they're able to cover their city, I think what we want to do now is put a deputy independent with a mental health worker to do rural areas, because we've got the coverage in the city, and that's a great thing. And it's proven success, not to my credit, to everybody else who was involved in that. Proven success, so that we don't have to recreate the wheel. We can hopefully do it for our rural areas and serve the outside of city limits of Reading.
That's great news. Yeah, and I can see how that would have shifted now that that's established.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's as you know, you had them on here. They've got a number of very successful stories which could have gone a completely different way had we not had that. And it's no different now. The level of calls for service regarding that team in the county and the rural areas is probably way lower than the city. The city has a lot of it because all the services are here. That's where a lot of the folks hang around. But the need is still there, and definitely the program is successful. We want to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. And the mental health Do you have a sense of the mental health professionals that you want to connect with? If they would be connected to a clinic, if they'd be connected to HHSA?
Yeah, either or. Sharon, I'm not so set in stone with that in my own mind because of personal relationships, I probably do, but I can't speak intelligibly to that because I don't know enough right. about how the program's working. But I do know, and the other disclaimer is, of course, I'm not a mental health professional, so I rely on those folks to tell me what's the best avenue to do that. But at some aspect, it's the same. The bottom line is this: there's the partnership between law enforcement, mental health, and serving that particular clientele.
Mm-hmm. What is on the board in terms of your top priorities? I was going to ask you later in the interview, but since you're thinking about it now, the top things that are facing your department or your department is embracing as, you know, these are top of shelf for us, things that we need to address.
Yeah, there's a number of them. The jail is still up there just because we reopened the third floor. It's actually the second floor, but everybody calls it third floor. It doesn't matter. It's semantics. Now that we've got that open, doesn't mean we've got all of our problems solved. It doesn't mean we have our staffing. We have pulled deputies and support staff off of various divisions within our agency to get that open. So now there's a transition that we plan that we have in place to get those folks back to their divisions and staff that jail. Well, that's all going really good. We've got a bunch of people in background. Everything's headed the right direction, but that's still probably the number one priority is to get that fully functional because it impacts the community so much. So if you set the jail aside, the drug task force, CINTIF, SHASTA, Interagency Narcotics Task Force, that's a kind of a priority of ours now because I don't know if you're aware, but the Reading Police Department, Anderson Police Department pulled out of the task force. So we had some restructuring to do. So it's us and probation and the DA and CHP all trying to, community health that are part of that too, our partners, HHSA is our partners of that too. We're trying to refocus that on fentanyl and human trafficking. And there's a lot of crossover with that with our marijuana eradication team because those things all come into play and tie together. And so we're trying to make that an efficient two units that work together again and serve the county. And when we talk about serving the county on that level, there's a lot of spillover on a lot of things. We've got I-5, the pipeline. We've got the immigration problem that's going on. We've got the cartel running grows. We've got fentanyl coming in. We've got human trafficking. All of that is tied together. So that is definitely a priority of ours because it is impacting our nice little Shasta County rural area in very negative fashion. We'd like to try to get a leg up on that. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a priority. I mentioned succession planning and leadership and stuff. So that has risen to the top for sure. You know, we like Reading, like Anderson, like probably most of the law enforcement agencies across this state and maybe this country are a very young agency now. We have deputies that are brand new, and we don't have that 7 to 12 year deputy experience in our sergeant ranks. We're missing a lot of that experience. So that mentoring, that development, that career long-term look for the sheriff's office is very important to me because I don't want to just come in, be able to achieve some things, walk out, and then leave a mess for somebody. I'd like that to be something that the community is proud of, continues to be proud of, and put the right people in the right places. So I'm putting a lot of effort into that lately as well.
So shifting a bit to some of the legal landscape, there are new laws, the way I understand it, coming into effect related to carrying guns and limits on where you can carry those guns. And I know from the perspective of many on the coalition, we've seen discussions on the Board of Supervisors and others about Second Amendment rights and Second Amendment counties. And so there's some concern about what kind of pushback there might be to laws that come down from the state. I mean, we've seen a bit of that, right?
Sure. Different. Oh, yeah.
So just wondering your position on all of that and what you anticipate having to navigate, if anything.
Yeah, there'll be a lot of navigation on that, Sharon. It's a gun rights are a very touchy subject, especially in California. I mean, California has really been dubbed the state that is the least gun friendly as far as politics go. So that makes it difficult. Now, the disclaimer I tell everybody with this is you have to look at it from this perspective. It doesn't matter if you are a gun right advocate or you're anti-gun. The fact of the matter is it's a constitutionally protected right. And so it's no different than the First Amendment and your freedom of speech. If you were somebody who was against that, that doesn't mean you can turn around and make a law in contrary to the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to that basic right, I happen to be a very pro-gun guy. I've hunted all my life, and I was raised around guns, and I respect them, and I very much appreciate that right to carry and own my firearm. So it's something I came into this saying I would stand up for, and I do. Now, when they make laws that are restrictive to gun ownership or parts that you can have on your gun or types of weapons, I don't view those as unconstitutional. They frustrate the heck out of me, but I don't like them, and I wish I didn't have to deal with a state that was like that, but those aren't unconstitutional stuff. When they make laws that are directly in violation of the Constitution and your right to bear arms, much like Senate Bill 2 has come out, at least partially, I will stand up and oppose that, and I will not enforce things that this administration, California administration, seems just based on their personal agenda. So that becomes a very slippery slope, right? I can't make laws counter to what the state laws are. That's not my role, but I do have a role in discretionary authority to enforce certain laws, and if they impose laws that I feel are unconstitutional, and obviously the court initially feels that too because of the stays they put on it, that's something I'm going to choose or not choose to enforce. Now, with that, I know this is a lot, this because it's a huge subject. There is a lot of apprehension by folks that, and a lot of anti-gun folks especially, that they have apprehension where people that have CCWs are allowed to carry, where they're allowed to carry that firearm, correct? So I would tell you this. It's not the CCW, the concealed weapons permit people, that you need to worry about. Those people are vetted by our office. They have gone through background checks. They have gone through training with these firearms. Concealed should mean that. Concealed, you should never even know that they have it on them anyways. And I can tell you the amount of concealed weapons, mass casualties we've had, or problems or criminal activity since I've been in office of sheriffs, and that's zero. And
meaning something that happened that was instigated by someone who had a concealed carry weapon permit.
Correct. Yeah. It's just not that crowd. Now, will it ever happen? It probably will. The laws of averages is, of course, somewhere down the line that's going to happen somewhere, but mostly these are not the people I'm concerned about. I'm not concerned about the concealed weapons permit carrier walking into a restaurant or going into a public area or going into a park or whatever it is. I'm concerned with the people with ill intent. And the people with ill intent don't worry about going and getting a concealed weapons permit. They have an agenda. They have access, and that they're going to do harm no matter what. Mm-hmm. So, and from a law enforcement perspective, those concealed weapons permit people are actually an ally for us if things go really south, and which, I mean, they'd have to go pretty bad for us to rely on those to help us. But the fact is, especially when you're talking about something like the sheriff's department and deputies that are spread so thin across this county and in some very politically volatile areas at times, those people could be a resource to us more than they can be a hindrance.
Mm-hmm. And how, well, two questions. One for listeners, Senate Bill 2, is that the one that specifies where you can't have a gun, even if you have a permit, like libraries and
correct
schools? And
So here's the thing that people need to understand about Senate Bill 2, Sharon, is to me, it's bifurcated. There's two different issues in Senate Bill 2. One is what I call unnecessary legislation, which is restricting the instructors that do the training and the permitting process. It restricts how I run the concealed weapons program, and you as a concealed weapons permit citizen, it changes the training requirements and stuff to get it. So those, they've really gone overboard with that, and I understand wanting to standardize the process and make it responsible, but it was super responsible already, and they've just went overboard with some stuff. But that's not unconstitutional. That's their right as a legislation. So I have to comply with that. You as a holder have to comply with that, and so on. The other part of the bill that is just absurd to me is the restricted areas and where you can carry. Now, this bill addresses several more areas that they're trying to restrict concealed carry. What people need to understand is the old laws that were still in place of government buildings and schools and stuff, SB 2 did not change that. Those are still valid no carry zones. They've just tried to add a bunch to that. It's all those that they, well, not all those, but 99% of those that they've tried to add to it, in my estimation, in my assessment, are unconstitutional for them to do. And that's what's going to court. That's what's being argued. That's what they're going to figure out.
So not so much the government buildings or schools.
Right. Those were places you couldn't carry prior to SB 2.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not addressing those. I'm addressing all this additional places they're trying to add on to it. They just mm-hmm. gone way overboard with it.
Yeah, and the ones just, again, because not everyone's going to go look up the Senate bill too, but the ones that are a concern for you or that you feel opposed to would be which?
Well, for instance, they have like a sidewalk adjacent to a different area. I mean, it is just so overreach that virtually a person with a concealed weapons permit can't even carry.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, there's another argument that goes on with the Second Amendment, and that is open carry, so you can carry it open, or concealed carry. So again, the Constitution allows you to bear arms. It doesn't say how you can bear arms. It doesn't say you have the right to open carry. It doesn't say you only have the right to conceal carry. They've left that up to the states and to the counties, and our particular county, as I came into this, is a concealed weapons permit process. So it's the manner in which you carry. They're not saying you can't carry. They're saying just how to carry. Okay, so that's constitutional in my opinion. But now when you're taking away their right, that's you can't do that. I get it. There's some areas we don't want people carrying guns into. You don't want mm-hmm. somebody going to court with a gun, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want
mm-hmm.
somebody walking into the school with a gun, which I'm not necessarily in agreement with that one, but okay, that's one that's on the books. But mm-hmm. when they start trying to restrict and take your right away, that's problematic for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I liked what your connection with freedom of speech, because it seems like publicly, or maybe in my classrooms, you know, that people take freedom of speech like anything goes, and there are limits there as well.
Yes.
You know, fire in a crowded, you know, house. There's slander and libel and
inciting a riot. Yeah, you can't do that with the First Amendment, and same thing with everything.
Right.
The people that create the controversy on all these issues, as you well know, are the extremists on either side. Whether you're way right or way left, the people that lose their common sense with these things are the reasons why we have the controversies.
You mentioned people who have gone through the permitting process and have a concealed carry could, in extreme situations, be an ally. And I know that one of the questions we asked you way early on, before you had even started, I think, was about concern among some community members about the militia and concern about unchecked militia. And there were all kinds of conversations in the media. And I know you fielded a lot of questions, too. the way it gets framed is whether or not there's a presence of the militia on the sheriff's department. And certainly I know that can be framed in a lot of different ways, that what people do in their private lives. And what limits there are on militia activities.
Okay, so the first one I'll address is there a presence of the militia and our employees, basically, is what you're asking me. The answer is no, there's not. And now, if somebody's affiliated, attending and stuff, that's employed by the Shasta County Sheriff's Office, I certainly don't know about it. There is policy within our agency that governs professionalism and how you act both on and off duty, and that some of that could cross those lines depending on what it is. Now, just because they are doesn't necessarily mean that there's an issue or that they're extremist, but you know, we try to monitor that and we try to keep our finger on what's going on with the militia and who's involved and who's affiliated and who's not. I know that there is a lot of apprehension from people about the militia, and there is probably the militia hasn't been they've been their own worst enemy on that, as far as that goes, in the past, because of some of the things some of the people that were involved with did, and because some of the ways they get their message out and what they are standing for. I would tell you it's probably like any other organization or any other group or profession, that they have some outliers who give them a horrible reputation and cause that apprehension. But I could also tell you there's some very good folks that are affiliated with that who have the basic ideals of what the United States and America stands for, and the freedoms and rights, then the core values of families and the way they see it should go. And they're not out to intimidate, harass, or hurt anybody. They're just looking out to protect their way of life. And those people don't concern me either. I mean, they or at least they don't intimidate me or cause me security concerns. I've actually, and I think I told you this before, when I was coming in the office, I met with the militia leadership, and we were very clear with each other on where we stood. You know, we are law enforcement. We will do the law enforcement work, and we will keep the peace and do what's, that's not their job, and we will not tolerate vigilantism or intimidation or any other tactics by the militia. And I didn't get it, it was a very healthy exchange and relationship that went on there. They weren't pushing back and saying, well, we don't, you know, we're anti-government or we don't care what you say, or it wasn't that at all. It was, in fact, they were one of those people that say, if things ever go bad and you need us, we'll be here for you. Mm-hmm. Great, that's great. If I need you, I'll call, but otherwise stay out of it. Law enforcement's ours, and they have. We haven't had a single problem with them.
And I know, you know, when you were mentioned the CCW and the allies, and I've certainly been in conversations in different institutions that I've worked for, where people said, like, okay, we, you know, we have ex-military here or whatever, and we're ready should something, you know, happen. As a sheriff's department, what do you think about or prepare for in being able to have those people be allies or call on them? And I know you're talking about like some extreme situation that we can't imagine.
Right.
But what do you think about how you might navigate that need or entertaining that?
Yeah, that's a fair question too. So the unfortunate thing is, if I did anything formal like that, people would be very apprehensive about that, right? They'd be like, oh my God, the sheriff's department is, you know, in bed with the militia and this is bad. It's not like that at all. So I'll tell you this, this is how, because I've already thought about this, if things really went south, how would I mobilize people to help the sheriff's office? I mean, first and foremost, we're going to go to our allied agencies, right? We're going to go to CHP, RPD, you know, DA, everybody, we're going to call on to help us. It would have to be super extreme before we started deputizing or asking for help from other groups. But if I did, Sharon, that would be based on the relationships I make throughout the county. So just like I told you, I met with the militia leadership. I know that militia leadership now. I have their contact information. They have mine. I know different folks that represent the different rural communities in Lakehead, Fall River Mills, Cottonwood, you know, Happy Valley, all those areas. I know people and I have a relationship and a respectful professional understanding with. And those are the people I would call to almost like phone tree, be my resources to help mobilize what I needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think our community really has appreciated the importance of those connections, particularly since the car fire, the importance of that sharing information and coming together. And U.S. Attorney Talbert, I spoke to him last week, and he really emphasized the importance of that. As well. So on to a completely uncontroversial topic of constitutional sheriffs.
Hey, before you go there, can I fall back and tell you one thing about those rural areas and that connection?
Yes.
So I had told you before when you're talking about accomplishments of what we've done, the rural deputy program that we instituted is a huge success for us. And it can get better, and we're working on making it better. But, you know, I had the constant question coming into this office of, hey, Sheriff, are we ever going to get a resident deputy up here? And I hear that from Lakehead, you're like from Shingletown, you hear that from everywhere in the rural area because they used to have them. And years ago, many years ago, the funding and those staffing positions went away. So I tell these folks, look, at even if I'm at fully staffed levels for patrol, I don't have enough staff to give you a resident deputy because they've taken away those positions. So to combat that, what we came up with was the rural deputy program. So we divided the county into different areas, regions, and we assign a deputy that works as full-time normal patrol to be the liaison for those different areas. So for instance, for Lakehead area, that region, we have a deputy assigned. Now that we pay that deputy overtime outside of his normal duties to go work special details and to get to know that community. So I'll pay him to go to parades, pay him to go to lion breakfasts. I will pay him to work drug houses. I'll pay him to work marijuana operations. Whatever it is that community's experience, they now have a connection with a deputy, a face, a liaison, a connection to the department. And each area has a different deputy like that. And they're getting to know that deputy and be able to relate their unique needs of that community to that deputy, and then we're able to serve it. So let's go back to the Lakehead example. So that deputy's up there. The community's having a rash of burglaries, and they relay this to the deputy. So that deputy starts to investigate it and figures out, we need to do a search warrant here, here, and here. So now we give him the authority to mobilize a bunch of our other deputies on overtime basement to serve those search warrants and do those investigations and solve that rural area's problem. And it's working really good so far.
That's nice. When I first moved to this county in 96, I lived up in Oak Run and Whitmore for several years. And
right.
Certainly that was a topic of conversation.
Yes.
You know, then I think that was even out, you know, I think things had, we didn't have rural deputies, I don't think, at the time.
Right.
But so it's been a while.
And so it's kind of a double-edged sword, right, Sharon? Because you move out into the rural areas for a reason. You want to be disconnected. You want to be away. You don't want the city life. Yet you want the city services. So it's kind of a dance, right? And we understand that, but and we want to serve them well, just like we do everywhere else. But there has to be an understanding that it's not going to be the same. You're not in the metropolitan area where we're running most of the patrols and calls for service and deputies.
Right, right. Like you want your peace, but you want your peace.
Yeah.
Right. So when another thing that you mentioned, there's so much you said in that first conversation, that you had joined an association of constitutional sheriffs, mm-hmm. learning more about their efforts and approaches. And so we're wondering, and certainly, you know, I'll just be transparent. We have some concerns about what we have learned nationally about constitutional sheriffs movement. So wondering what you've learned, do you consider yourself a constitutional sheriff, and how you navigate the concerns that organizations like us might have around that?
Okay. That's true. I did join that and, to for a learning base and to understand what it's all about. I tell you, to answer your question right off the bat, yes, I absolutely consider myself a constitutional sheriff. I hope that every sheriff in the United States considers himself a constitutional sheriff. The difference is that definition of a constitutional sheriff. My definition doesn't meet the definition of maybe what that organization has branded itself to be. And what I, one of the biggest things I've learned about that is if I don't meet the exact definition and the exact agenda that they want me to meet, then they don't consider me a constitutional sheriff, which I don't care because I don't have those people dictate what I do and serve my community. I will stand up for the Constitution and what's constitutionally right every day of the week. That's what I'm elected to do. That doesn't mean I'm going to do it by somebody else's definitions or somebody else's terms. And what I've got out of, there's a lot of good stuff that comes with a constitutional sheriff. Don't get me wrong. There's the foundationally and principle and morally and ethically, I agree with most everything there. I don't agree with how they go about it. And I don't agree with the extreme propaganda that comes with it. That's the part that has really turned me off to it, is a lot of propaganda, a lot of push, trying to get you to be and act a certain way. And if you don't, then they turn against you. And I don't buy into any of that. But that doesn't mean I'm not a constitutional sheriff. That just means I'm not a constitutional sheriff by somebody else's definition.
Yeah. And I know not all our listeners, we haven't really discussed that on the program before. And people come from a lot of backgrounds. So could you describe for you how you define it for yourself? And what are those points of contention or what you don't agree with that people who decide to Google it after hearing you talk about it, you know, might look up?
Well, to me, it means just that. You know, I was elected to represent the majority of the citizens that I serve. And sometimes that majority isn't always exactly in line with my personal way of thinking. But it's not my job to act on my own agenda. It's my job to represent the people I serve. And when there is a constitutionally hot topic issue, whether that's gun rights or COVID or anything else like that, it's up to me to sort through the information, try to find the facts, try to find where my constituents lie on the issue and what best serves the greater good of the county, right? That's who I represent. And always I will err on the side of what's constitutionally correct and right and valid, versus what maybe state law in controversy that may be. That is my job. I have to stand up for that, and I have to protect those rights. But again, I won't let that be driven on emotional-based decisions. I won't let that be driven on special interests of any group, whatever side of the mark you're on. And I definitely won't drive it based on politics. I don't care if you don't vote for me again on the next election. I'm not in it for that. I absolutely told myself from the beginning, I will not be in it for votes. I'm in it for what's best for the citizens of this county. And that's how I'm going to act every time.
Mm-hmm.
That's my definition of a constitutional sheriff.
Okay. And, what I want to make sure I understand, and I'm not an expert in constitutional sheriffs, you know, but it sounds like there are those in that movement who feel like they have the right, the purview, the knowledge to interpret the Constitution independently.
In lies the problem of what the constitutional sheriff is, the interpretation of the Constitution. It's not even up to me to interpret that. Sharon, it's the courts do that. That's why we have a system in this country.
Right.
And that's how that Constitution came about. And that's the founding principles of this nation. Mm-hmm. I don't interpret the Constitution. I enforce what the reality is and what the upheld opinion of the courts is with the Constitution. Now, when we're talking about Senate Bill 2, and I said, I feel that these things are unconstitutional. Hear me loud and clear. I feel that they are unconstitutional. It doesn't mean they're unconstitutional. We're waiting for those decisions to come out through the court. They may make a decision that I don't like. Then again, I can, based on my knowledge and expertise and references, which are usually legal opinions, to make a decision about my enforcement philosophy with those, but I don't change state law, and I definitely don't change constitutional law.
Mm-hmm. So to put that part in context, reading where the legal opinion is murky or in process, you will use that to inform the level or degree to which you're enforcing. But correct. Something that becomes state law or is deemed constitutional, you see that as your job, your responsibility to enforce.
Correct. And I would tell you a step further, I don't necessarily rely on just California law or California constitution law. The United States Constitution trumps all of that. And so it needs to get to the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court to rule on the decision, not just our state. Our state, unfortunately, has an agenda many times, and not just with the gun thing, with a lot of different things. And my struggle in my position is that, again, I don't like people running their own agendas based on what they think is right. And you need to do what's right for the greater good and for the state mm-hmm. and for the constituents. And a lot of times what the state does is in direct opposition of their constituents. And I struggle with that a lot because it's not right. It's not what government is meant to serve.
If state law is clear and nothing's murky within the state system and something has not moved up to the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. we're not seeing any process just yet, and it makes you queasy. You feel like, I'm not sure. What do you do with that?
It's not as simple as just making my own decision. There's a lot of education, a lot of self-education, a lot of, again, referencing that goes on for me to arrive at a sound decision. And that could be, so let's take the masking thing, for example. That's a perfect one that created a lot of controversy and division, not just in our county, but across the state, across the United States. So in something like that, when COVID comes out and they come out with these restrictions and, you know, wanting to shut down businesses and stuff, that made me unsettled, very unsettled. I was chief of police and I wasn't in the sheriff's seat of Anderson. And after I did all my research, both on the health side of things, the politics side of things, the legal side of things, I arose at a decision, and I had to work with my city council and city manager on this, came to the decision, we're not going to be the mask police for restaurants and enforce that. If they're choosing to stay open and the state comes in and revokes their license or something, that's the state, but we're not going to stand in their way as our local government. That is something we're going to choose not to enforce. That's an example of how I go about those things.
Mm-hmm. What if the city council had said, which I know is implausible, but at the time, because I was very aware of all that going on, said, Mike, we really want you to go in there. We want people in every restaurant, you know, whatever. And you were concerned about what's your role in that?
That'd be a tough one. That's absolutely a tough one, right? Everybody has a boss. Everybody has to answer mm-hmm. to somebody. Mm-hmm. And we would have had some conflict then, I think. I think that probably the next step would have been there. Well, maybe we start getting the opinion of our city, or of our constituents in our city, and we hold some town hall meetings, and we hold some business owner meetings, and we hold some other things to try to get what the general sentiment is. And maybe if it all goes that way, again, that's who I'm serving mm-hmm. and that's what we have to do, then I do it. But just basing it on a certain groups or a certain entity without getting all the input, I don't like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've had various conversations with U.S. Attorney Talbert, with Chief Schuler, with a number of different agencies. We just had the CHP commander at our meeting. And I like to ask people about some of the misconceptions the public has about what you can respond to. And it's so interesting that you went through FBI training too, to help people understand how, you know, which things that come to your attention are yours. And when it looks like, because we often have people say, what, nothing happened. Mm-hmm. And I know from the hate crimes task force, well, we may not know what's happening too. So I'm wondering how you explain to people what's in your bucket, you know, what you do, and the ways in which things that may not be yours get shared or passed on to other agencies.
Wow, what a loaded question.
Well, you know.
No.
Go big or go home.
Yeah. Okay, so the misconception that people have is that things that they feel are criminal and should rise, quote unquote, to the full extent of the law may not in fact be the case when you dissect what is actually criminal and what's not. So a perfect example of that is we talked about prior about harassment or social media pressure, bullying, and that sort of thing. A lot of times, in fact, probably the majority of the time, that is not criminal, what's going on. That is very civil in nature, where there needs to be restraining orders or stay away orders or civil lawsuit, defamation, that sort of thing. Not criminal. And people expect the police, the sheriff's office, to step in and file a case against this person, or I want this person prosecuted. Well, when we look at it and what level it rises to, it's usually a civil issue or a restraining order, a private issue. And that is not something that law enforcement's going to always stick their nose in, because our job is to protect the life and property and rights of people, not civil stuff. We don't get involved in that. Now, do I have a civil division in the sheriff's office? Yes, we do. But that civil division isn't out enforcing civil laws. It's doing stuff like evictions and paperwork and handling stuff for people. It's not our, it's not within our power to do that. And so that's one of the big misconceptions of people of what's going on. The other one is, and I'll tell you about, you made a comment of, well, we, you know, people think sometimes that, well, nothing ever happened. And people do think that, and not always, but a good percentage of the time, that's our fault as law enforcement, because we don't follow up. We don't close the loop. And that, talk about the culture change in the sheriff's office. So that's one of the things I've been trying to teach these men and women that work with me is, hey, you got this call from Sharon. You went and handled the call. You did everything right. Did you follow up with her and tell her, hey, thanks for the call. We arrested the guy down the street. He went to jail. You don't have to tell them the details. They're not privy to the details. But at least a little follow-up to close the loop goes a long way. Mm. And we're not good at that in law enforcement, and especially when I'm dealing with a generation who is much younger than I am, like in their 20s, right? And they don't have a whole lot of life experience. They don't see the value in that. They don't know the value in that. And I'm trying to teach that and trying to make that part of the culture as well.
Mm. Well, on that part of, we've spoken to quite a few people, journalists, elected officials. Some of it appears to be stronger against women, perhaps, of that online and harassment and bullying, and nationally, not just here. And we've also had in the backdrop, you know, these mass shootings, and then we have conversations about all the telltale signs, right, mm-hmm. of the sure. mass shooters. So at what level do threats or of physical harm rise to the level of criminality or bordering on criminality if something has not happened? I know U.S. Attorney Talbert talked to us about the importance of reporting so that there's a trail.
Yes, absolutely.
So I just wanted to hear from you about...
So a lot of those threats that people get are general or not specific in nature, but the tone's definitely there. And they're not wrong for interpreting it that way. They just don't understand that it's not criminal in nature. Now, does that mean I don't want those reported? No, that's not what that means. We do want those reported. The expectation of the reporting party is what is difficult to manage. So you call in because you're feeling very threatened and very intimidated by whatever event has come, social media, let's say. And so we take your information and we look at it, and when we start dissecting it, it's not criminal at all, but it's definitely, the tone is there. So here's what you probably don't know we do, is we vet a lot of that out. We do a research on the person making the threats or the implications, because if they are belonging to certain organizations and flying certain like racism or defamation or anything on their type of social media accounts, it causes for a digger deep dive and look and background on them, and to vet them out so they are not somebody who is a danger to society. And a lot of times they're not. A lot of times they're people are just like to run their mouths and posture and do the things they do. But every now and then we hit one that hits the marks, or we say, you know, no, we probably ought to follow up with a search warrant or a visit and an interview and these things. And those go on all the time. Now, those are the things that they will not follow up and recontact. So let's say, Sharon, you reported that, and I did everything I just told you about as part of following up with what you reported. I'm not going to come back and tell you all that information, because there is privacy rights for that person, and there's details involved in that investigation of law enforcement, and law enforcement only is privy to. Now, what I could call you up and say is, Sharon, you made this report. Appreciate the fact that here's things you can do to protect yourself. You can get a restraining order. You can do this, do that. You do that. Stay off social media, maybe. And I could give you that and tell you I have looked into it. We don't deem it as a threat to society or anybody at this point, but we are monitoring. Mm-hmm. I could give you that, but that's about all you'll get. And to be honest with you, we don't have the time to do all of those. We get so much of that coming in these days. It's just the norm now, unfortunately. And don't get me wrong, Sharon, and folks listening, I do not condone that behavior at all. I don't like it. It disappoints me as a country that we've come to that. But again, my profession, I deal in a world of criminality, and that's what I have to look at. And if it's criminal, we'll proceed and we will intervene. If it's not, we don't.
What are your hopes for what you can bring to the department and to the community for the rest of your time as sheriff, however long that may be.
That's easy. My hopes is, one, that this community will not be as fragmented and quit being polarized and come together for the greater good of the community. And my role in that hopefully can be more than it is. Right now, I am navigating pretty much my agency, and I don't have this sphere of influence that I wish I could have with allied organizations throughout this county. And I'd like to be the collaborative focus that helps pull those together and makes a difference for the community going forward. That's my long-term goal before I get out of here. I'd like to leave you with this as your sheriff, is this is a position I hold and a job I do. It's not who I am. I love my family. I have my granddaughter here for 4 days. I love to train dogs. I love to participate in community events and hang out. That is really who I am. I'm doing what I do because I believe in it, and I believe in law enforcement, and I believe in protecting community. That's the reason I do what I do. I'm approachable. Even if you don't like what I'm doing and you want to come up and give me your opinion, I'm actually all right with that too. I just ask if I'm in with my granddaughter or my kids, maybe not go off on a bender on me then.
Thank you so much, Sheriff Johnson.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. And again, Sharon, if your listeners have any follow-up questions or anything and they want you to ask me, they can go through you and you can email me or call me or whatever, and I will answer those questions to the best of my ability. You can relay the information back.
I believe in being ready. For the time is drawing near, brothers. sisters, please get